Thank you, thank you. And now the winner of the best Central Wisconsin community radio station as voted by us computer voices, WNRB.
This is 93.3 WNRB Wausau.
Free people, free radio.
And now, the man who brought down Nixon, Mike Cannon.
Hello again and welcome back to this week's Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Each week during the third hour of this program, I like to bring you This Week in Palestine, giving you a non-Western, non-Zionist take on the news from a Palestinian perspective. That'll be coming up shortly. After that will be a short documentary of some of the secret government things you should be aware of, like the continuation of government emergency powers that the government has to control homegrown strife in America. After that, we'll be talking a little bit about said strife with audio from a half-hour documentary from the crew at the Submedia Gang, who did an awesome job with a video presentation of the movement of anarchists in America and their response and the government response and oppression during the two political presidential conventions this past year in Denver and in Minneapolis. After that, we should have a couple of minutes at the top of the hour for more music of love, rage, and resistance, the best kind of music there is. A reminder, if you'd like to contact this show, please feel free to write to themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Cannon is spelled C-A-N-N-O-N. So that's one long run-on word, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Or you can slow mail at P.O. Box 244, Mosinee, Wisconsin, 54455. That's P.O. Box 244, Mosinee, Wisconsin, 54455. Now back to the show.
Groovy.
This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for October 4th through 10th, 2008. This week, Israeli military stepped up attacks in the West Bank and its naval forces continue to attack Palestinian fishermen in Gaza. Meanwhile, Palestinians are closer than ever to unity agreement in Cairo. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with non-violent actions in the West Bank, where harvesting olive trees becomes a task that needs international support and non-violent intervention. At least 14 protesters were wounded in the village of Bilayin near the West Bank city of Ramallah Friday afternoon. The residents of Bilayin, accompanied by international and Israeli human rights activists, marched following the Friday prayer towards the gate in the fence in an attempt to go to their land to harvest the olive trees. Israeli troops operating at the gate prevented them and showered them with rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas. Four were moved to the hospital for treatment as their wounds were moderate, while the others suffered light injuries and were treated by field medics. The protesters carried signs condemning the wall and fence Israel is building on the village's land, while others carried ladders and tools they used to harvest the olive trees. The olive harvest started in the early hours of the morning in the village. However, due to the wall, the Israeli villagers could not harvest the trees behind the wall. As a result of the construction of the wall in Bilayin, the village lost nearly half of its land. The Israeli High Court ordered the army to remove the wall in a way that would allow the villagers to retrieve almost half of the confiscated land. However, the court ruling is still not implemented. Meanwhile, in the nearby village of Na'alin, Israeli forces prevented Palestinian farmers from harvesting their olives. At least 100 Israeli peace activists came to assist in the harvest in solidarity with the villagers of Na'alin. The presence of international and Israeli activists during previous harvest seasons has allowed many Palestinians to harvest the olives, especially in orchards where Israeli settlements or military bases were set up. According to some of the peace activists, Israeli forces used tear gas and concussion grenades to disperse the farmers and their supporters who were heading to the olive orchards. However, no injuries were reported. In the southern part of the West Bank, the Israeli soldiers dispersed international Israeli and Palestinian activists who assembled in a protest against the wall in the village of Al-Masara near Bethlehem on Friday afternoon. The protest started after the noon prayer in the village and headed towards the construction site of the wall. However, Israeli troops halted them and prevented them from continuing towards the wall and showered them with tear gas and concussion grenades. No injuries were reported. affected. The villagers of Al-Ma'sara and the neighboring villages have been organizing weekly protests in the past 2 years in bid to stop the construction of the wall on their land, which is the main source of income for most of the villagers. For IMEMC.org, this is George Rishmawi. As Palestinian-Israeli peace talks are stalled, different talks are underway in the Egyptian capital of Cairo. The ongoing talks are intra-Palestinian that are meant to reach a settlement of current Palestinian division. Meanwhile, Israeli foreign minister in charge of the Israeli government assured this week that Palestinian-Israeli peace negotiations should continue. IMEMC's Jessica Husley has more.
Rival Palestinian factions in Gaza and the West Bank are currently meeting in Cairo under the patronage of Egyptian mediators in order to sort out internal differences following more than a year of separation between both Palestinian regions. The talks are focused on ending the differences between Hamas in Gaza and Fatah in the West Bank, as Hamas sources said this week that an agreement on major points of standoff have been maintained. Representatives of Fatah and Hamas have both confirmed that they will meet by the end of this month, preceded by a trilateral meeting involving Egyptian mediators. The main points of conflict include reforming the Palestine Liberation Organization on a national and professional basis, reconstructing the security services in light of 2006 election results, and returning the situation back prior to June of 2007. The two parties formed a national unity government in February of 2007 after meeting in the Saudi Arabia city of Mecca. 4 months later, fighting broke out in Gaza, resulting in Hamas takeover of the coastal region and ejection of Fatah allied security services from the strip. At the Palestinian-Israeli political level, Israeli foreign minister and chairwoman of the caretaker government assured her Palestinian counterparts that the peace process will continue as planned in the Washington-sponsored Annapolis summit meeting in November of last year. Her Palestinian negotiations counterpart, Ahmed Khoury, said that any Palestinian-Israeli talks, excluding the status of occupied East Jerusalem, will not move forward. Both sides have been negotiating over reaching a two-state solution by the end of this year, in accordance with the outcome of the Annapolis conference. However, commentators believe that such a deal is not possible due to the resignation of Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. For IMEMC, this is Jessica Holsey.
As truce deal in Gaza enters its fourth month, Israeli naval forces continue to shoot at fishermen while on board their ships near the Gaza shores. Meanwhile, Israeli sources in Gaza warned this week of an Israeli military invasion of Gaza soon. More with IMEMC's Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
This week, the Israeli naval forces shot and wounded a Palestinian fisherman while on board his ship near the Gaza shores. The attacks towards the fishermen have been non-stop since an Egyptian brokered a truce deal between Israel and the Gaza-based factions came into effect in June of this year. A Scottish international activist, who is still present in Gaza from the Free Gaza boat, which he broke the siege on August 23, took footage of the Israeli naval vessels while shooting at fishermen. The assaults on Palestinian fishing boats come as Israel imposes a crippling blockade on the coastal region since the Islamist Hamas party took over the area amidst factional fighting with Fatah party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in June of last year. Meanwhile, this week the Israeli soldiers manning the northern Gaza Strip checkpoint of Eretz denied entry of a medical crew to Gaza. The delegation is made up of 9 Arab Israeli doctors who are supposed to conduct surgeries for a stranded patient. The human rights group, Physicians for Human Rights, condemned the Israeli denial of such doctors during this time when Israel continues to close the Gaza crossings. The local popular committee for breaking the Israeli blockade on Gaza declared this week that the death toll of patients who are unable to get medical attention from hospitals outside of the Gaza Strip due to the crossing's closure has mounted to 247. For other news, the spokesman of the Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of the ruling Hamas party in Gaza, Abu Ubaida, warned this week of what he believed an imminent Israeli military invasion of Gaza. The Hamas spokesman believed that underway Israeli military exercises around the eastern part of Gaza are meant at invading the region, expressing Palestinian resistance factions' right to defend any Israeli attacks. Earlier this week, Israeli army spokesman Avi Haidari confirmed in a press statement that current army exercises are routine ones and have nothing to do with any army actions against the coastal territory. On the internal level, the Hamas-led government halted arrest campaigns against supporters of the rival Fatah Party as national unity talks are underway in Cairo with the purpose of wrapping up the division profile once and for all. For IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Mighiri in Gaza.
This week, Israeli military stepped up attacks on the West Bank, mainly farmlands, amidst the olive-picking season as the Israeli soldiers shot and wounded several residents. IMEMC's Mark Turner with the details.
This week, the Israeli military tightened security measures imposed on the West Bank by closing the region completely under the pretext of Jewish holidays. Also, Israeli troops attacked Palestinian farmers while working in their olive farms, erecting a fence around a 3-dunam-width farm in the city of Tel Karem. Farmers in the city of Salfit reported several Israeli military assaults while harvesting their olives, which is a main source of income for the West Bank population. The Minister of Agriculture, Mohammed Al-Agha, warned of what he called a systematic Israeli assault on the Palestinian agricultural sector due to the attacks on olive farmers. 5 farmers in Kabatia City complained to the Israeli magistrate court about Israeli settlers' unwillingness to evacuate an illegal settlement block in their area. The reference settlement was supposed to be evacuated last year, according to a decision by the Israeli government. In the meantime, the Israeli military stormed a number of West Bank cities, including Jenin, Tel Karem, Hebron, and Bethlehem, rounding up more than a dozen residents. 12 residents were reportedly detained at several checkpoints in the West Bank, as Israeli further restricted movement of Palestinians during the Jewish holidays of Yom Kippur and Sukkot. This week, in the city of Nablus, Israeli troops shot and wounded a number of Palestinian residents during clashes between locals and Israeli soldiers. In other news, Hamas said this week that the Fatah-affiliated Palestinian security services in the West Bank arrested 17 members and supporters of Hamas in several West Bank cities. The de facto governments of Hamas in Gaza and Fatah in the West Bank have been trading arrests since Hamas consolidated internal control of the Gaza Strip in June of last year. Mahmoud Abbas subsequently outlawed the democratically elected Islamist Party in the West Bank. Abbas has called Hamas's seizure of Gaza a coup against legitimacy. Elsewhere this week, clashes broke out between dozens of Arab and Jewish residents in the Israeli city of Akka. Israeli police revealed that the clashes erupted when, during the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, an Arab family drove their car within a predominantly Jewish Orthodox area of the city. For IMEMC.org, this is Mark Turner.
And that was just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant update, check out our website www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This week's report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and George Shmawi.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
During debates on the banker bailout bill on the floor of Congress last week, Congressman Brad Sherman made a startling revelation.
Many of us were told in private conversations that if we voted against this bill on Monday, that the sky would fall, the market would drop 2,000 or 3,000 points the first day, another couple thousand the second day, and a few members were even told that there would be martial law in America if we voted no.
Martial law is defined as the rule by military authorities imposed on a civilian population. According to an article in the Army Times last month, the administration's threats of implementing martial law is not idle talk. In this shocking article, the U.S. Army admits they're bringing a combat team back from Iraq to continue their mission in America, and that this combat team will be assigned to NORTHCOM to assist in the event of civil unrest, in crowd control through non-lethal weaponry. This deployment is, of course, in direct violation of long-standing laws known as Posse Comitatus and the Insurrection Act, which strictly prohibit the U.S. Army from policing American citizens on American soil. While such extraordinary steps toward the open implementation of martial law on the streets of America might seem like the Bush administration's last-ditch effort to keep the public in check while they rob the Treasury of hundreds of billions for their banker friends, it is crucial to understand that this is only the final stage in a careful plan that has been unfolding for decades through both Republican and Democrat administrations. Government plans to suspend the Constitution and effect martial law have been taking place behind the scenes under continuity of government contingencies, first exposed in the mid-1980s and raised by Congressman Jack Brooks during the Iran-Contra hearings.
Colonel North, in your work at the NSC, were you not assigned at one time to work on plans for the continuity of government in the event of a major disaster?
Mr. Chairman,
I believe that question touches upon a highly sensitive and classified area, so may I request that you not touch upon that, sir?
I was particularly concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I read in Miami papers and several others that there had been a plan developed by that same agency, a contingency plan in the event of emergency that would suspend the American Constitution. And I was deeply concerned about it and wondered if that was the area in which he had worked. I believe it was.
May I most respectfully request that that matter not be touched upon at this stage. If we wish to get into this, I'm certain arrangements can be made for an executive session.
Urban warfare drills took place throughout the 90s, with American troops training with foreign soldiers to arrest and detain U.S. citizens.
What you're seeing is real. April 10th through April 20th in Swansboro, North Carolina. This has been repeated across the country in the last 2 years. So-called urban warfare training in America. Of course, in the case of Swansboro, they actually pulled people over and searched their vehicles with the local police department. A local listener sent me this video of the Swansboro incident. You see, they take out groups of young officers from across the country in the Marine Corps and teach them that it's okay to go into American towns and cities and take over the city halls and search vehicles. In this training exercise, it became real. They become so arrogant, they just follow their orders and began to search people's vehicles. And as you're about to find out, it's not just the Marines, it's the Army, too, in Central Texas.
These drills quickly became reality, as in 2005, the National Guard was deployed in the wake of Hurricane Katrina to seize legally held guns from law-abiding citizens against their will and at gunpoint.
No one will be able to be armed. We will take all weapons.
Police Department! Police Department, everyone home!
All of a sudden, they were banging on the front door, the side door, and the back door, and they said, let us in. I said, it's not even loaded, and I dropped it on the floor.
You got a gun.
Well, they punched me in the face. Look at my black and blue marks. Look at what they did to me.
In 2006, a secret government program came to light, which is recruiting clergy members to preach obedience to government in the event that martial law is declared. In 2007, the program was confirmed on CBS News.
If martial law were enacted here at home, like depicted in the movie The Siege, easing public fears and quelling dissent would be critical. And that's exactly what the clergy response team, as it's called, helped accomplish in New Orleans.
Jeff, the primary thing that we say to anybody is let's cooperate and get this thing over with, and then we'll settle the differences once the crisis is over.
Such clergy response teams would walk a tightrope between the needs of the government versus the wishes of the public.
In a lot of cases, these clergy would already be known in the neighborhoods in which they're helping to defuse that situation.
For the clergy, one of the biggest tools that they will have in helping calm the public down or obey the law is the Bible itself, specifically Romans, Romans 13.
Because the government is established by the Lord, you know, and that's what we believe in the Christian faith. That's what's stated in the Scripture.
And on May 9th, 2007, President Bush signed off on National Security Presidential Directive 51. This top-secret continuity of government plan effectively makes the president a dictator, allowing him to declare a national emergency for any reason whatsoever and implement martial law without the approval of Congress. The plan itself is so secret that not even members of the Homeland Security Committee in Congress are allowed to see its contents.
But now they've denied the entire Homeland Security Committee of the United States House of Representatives access to their so-called detailed plan to provide for continuity of government. They say, trust us. Trust us, the people who brought us Katrina, to be competent in face of a disaster. Trust us, the people who brought us warrantless wiretapping and other excesses eroding our civil liberties. Trust us.
These are just a few of the dozens of preparations that have already been completed to phase martial law in incrementally, bringing it about in stages, so an official declaration of military rule need not even be made. But if martial law is already a reality, what excuse will be used to turn the military against the American public?
Have you heard about this new thing going on in Great Britain that Al-Qaeda written up all these Britons, essentially, 1,400 strong, apparently, in a new, what's being called a new white Al-Qaeda army? Tougher to detect, potentially.
Yeah, because so they're not Muslims. They look just
exactly
like regular British people.
They're converts.
In 2001, Section 802 of the Patriot Act made any criminal offense, even misdemeanors, classifiable as terrorist activity. In 2006, the Military Commissions Act gave the executive branch the authority to declare U.S. citizens and residents unlawful enemy combatants and detain them in undisclosed locations indefinitely. And now, H.R. 1955, known as the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act, currently awaiting passage by the Senate, will effectively outlaw dissent of the government, even on the internet. It seems the table has been set for those citizens who resist any government decree to be dealt with as terrorists by the U.S. military. And now that the banker bailout bill has been passed despite fierce public outcry, dissent has never been more rife amongst the general population.
Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
Here's audio from the video documentary called Ground Noise and Static from the people at Submedia.
Telling and reliving the collective story of the Republican National Convention is fundamentally important for resistance movements in the U.S. By remembering these huge sparks in activity, we remind ourselves that we can confront the state in all its might, and all of a sudden, another world seems so much closer and so much more real. But just as important as telling our collective stories is learning from our collective experiences.
In this election, there is something happening in America.
I know these are tough times for many of you. You're worried about my friends, my dear friends, please, please don't be diverted by the ground noise and the static.
The RNC Welcoming Committee, the anarchist anti-authoritarian body organizing for the protests, started publicly organizing a full year and a half before the convention. This amount of lead time is something that hasn't been prevalent in the North American protest culture since the summit protest era at the height of the global justice movement. On Labor Day weekend 2007, exactly a year before the convention, the RNC Welcoming Committee held a weekend-long planning and training meeting, attended by hundreds of activists representing organizations from around the country.
What kind of activities are expected for the protest?
Well, something that came out of the first BRNC was that we were going to blockade the streets and try to prevent the delegates from reaching the XL Energy Center and, in the Welcoming Committee's words, crash the convention. The RNC Welcoming Committee is not planning any actions or protests ourselves. We are more or less just creating the clearinghouse for people to come through us to have those actions happen.
We plan to provide you with over 300 buses and hundreds of private cars to transport you from your lodgings to the XL Energy Center all 4 days of the convention, with more than several freeway entrances into downtown St. Paul, including the I-94 Kellogg exit, the I-94 5th Street exit, the 35E 11th Street exit, the 35E University exit, the I-94 10th Street exit, and the I-94 12th Street exit. Getting to the XL Energy Center might be half the adventure.
Awesome.
With the Coalition to March on the RNC and Stop the War scheduled to march on the Excel Center the same day as the RNC Welcoming Committee's Crash the Convention's blockade, organizers for both groups worried about how the two actions would play out together in the streets. But in February 07, organizers for both groups came together to establish the St. Paul Principles.
What it was a way to make sure that all the work of the local organizers wouldn't get pushed aside when the national groups came in. We've had a lot of success having other groups sign on to the St. Paul Principles, and it's actually pretty historic. First thing mentioned is our solidarity will be based on respect for diversity of tactics and the plans of other groups. Meaning, while people might disagree with tactics, we all recognize which side of the barricades we're on. There will be a separation of time and space for actions. And what that means is we're going to make sure that if someone's having an action in an area, that nobody's going to be bringing their action down on that one that's already going on. The third one, which is a pretty new agreement for people to sign on to before a march or an action like this, is any criticisms or debates of tactics, individuals, it will be kept internal. We're not going to go to the media and denounce this group who has different tactics than us. The last one is that we oppose any state repression of dissent, including surveillance, infiltration, disruption, and violence. We agree not to assist law enforcement actions against activists and others. It's pretty nice to see that people seem to be coming around to the idea that when it comes to a protest, the police are very firmly on one side.
This is your final warning. You will be subject to chemical units if you do not disperse and clear this street.
In some sense, the Battle of the RNC was kicked off on Thursday, August 28th, with the erection of Bushville, a tent city modeled after the Hoovervilles of the Great Depression. This encampment on Harriet Island would serve as a home for the poor and homeless arriving in the Twin Cities to protest the Republican National Convention.
Homeless people sleep every single night across St. Paul. The only difference between myself and other homeless people that would be here in St. Paul is the fact that they don't have signs up. Is that the difference? Is because we're saying something about what's happening in this country?
We know our families don't have the kind of health care that they need. They don't have the kind of housing that they need. We live in a rich country, and none of us should have to be dealing with 9,000 police officers just to talk about what's wrong in this country.
On Friday, August 29th and Saturday, August 30th, police made a series of preemptive strikes against the movement. Armed with a search warrant, police kicked in the door of the RNC Welcoming Center, a convergence space for protesters.
They ended up breaking through the door. All of us were in there. They had us get down on our stomachs as we were watching a movie. We were both terrified. The cops went and started plastic cuffing everybody for our safety and for theirs, supposedly, as he is crying and in hysterics.
The Ramsey County Sheriff's Department and the SPPD raided the RNC convergence space and detained over 50 people in an attempt to preempt planned protests of the RNC on Monday. Looking for items found in any Twin Cities house like jars, paints, and rags, this attempt to portray us as criminals and destroy our credibility has already backfired, as evidenced as the masses of people who have come to support us.
Frank, it's Gina. There's two more house raids going on in Minneapolis. One's at
93.3 WNRB LP Wausau.
At 3240 17th Avenue South. Just thought you might want to know.
Me and my partner were sleeping, and I was naked, and officers came and separated us and made me lie on the floor naked for about an hour.
By the time the first wave of raids ended, at least three houses had been invaded, and eight RNC Welcoming Committee organizers had been arrested on felony conspiracy to riot charges. In response, the legal, communications, and community outreach structures jumped into high gear, legally contesting the arrests and the searches, providing solid, accurate information, and running rumor control, and generating a widespread expression of community outrage.
PFC Shane Penley, age 19, Sauk Village, Illinois, died in Iraq April 6, 2008.
We will remember you.
August 31st. We remember, say the Veterans for Peace, as they march on the Excel Center to read out the names of U.S. soldiers and Iraqi civilians killed in the war.
Unknown Iraqi child's bloody face and loss of right eye.
We will remember you.
Let them in! They have served this country! Let them in!
Nine are arrested for breaching the security perimeter. Monday, opening day for the RNC. At the state capitol, the people assembled, preparing to march in peaceful protest to the Excel Center. Estimates vary on the size of the crowd, between 10 and 30,000 people. The police were armed with extended batons, pepper spray, tasers, tear gas guns, automatic rifles, and guns firing less lethal projectiles. Today, public order would be kept by 3,700 police from across Minnesota, with the help of thousands more from over 30 agencies. The RNC Welcoming Committee had divided St. Paul into seven sectors, so that groups throughout the country could coordinate their actions and blockade as many access points as possible. Each group created a unique blockade, independent yet collaborative. Major entrance and travel points in each sector, from highway on-ramps to busy intersections to hotel shuttle bus loading spaces, were claimed by the affinity groups. Traffic was blocked for several hours in downtown St. Paul, and during the chaotic scene, the swarm of protesters was able to disable at least two buses by slashing their tires and smashing their windows. Delegates were delayed in getting to the Excel Center, and hundreds of America's political elite were directly and personally confronted by an energetic declaration of opposition.
I'm shutting down. They are going to get ready to break down here. I said the riot, the protesters have came down. The police are on their way down here, and I am going to shut down before they spray.
Police reacted aggressively, strategically and methodically working to force protesters out of key intersections and off of main thoroughfares. They used blunt object force, chemical weapons, and concussion grenades in an attempt to disperse, or at least push back, the crowds. And when their numbers allowed it, police surrounded and arrested entire groups of protesters, reporters, and bystanders.
Put your hands behind your back! You're under arrest!
From that day on, the St. Paul police held a constant assault against all RNC protesters, regardless of their affiliation or permit status. We remember the U.S. tank that fired on the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad, killing Spanish journalist Jose Cuso, and the U.S. missile attacks on the offices of Al Jazeera in both Iraq and Afghanistan shortly after the U.S. invaded those two countries. Altogether, at least 217 journalists and media assistants have been killed in Iraq since the start of the U.S.-led invasion, according to Reporters Without Borders. Recently, indie media journalist Sally Grace Ehler was raped and murdered in Oaxaca, Mexico, in a case linked to political repression, much like the case of indie media videographer Brad Will, who in 2006 was gunned down in Oaxaca while covering the teacher's strike. Journalists serve as the eyes and ears of democracy. Without free access to the story, there can be no freedom of the press. In St. Paul, the police escalated their usual heavy-handed attack on media activists by first detaining, nearly a week before the convention began, members of the Glass Bead Collective.
They confiscated our cameras. They confiscated our notes. They confiscated our computers. What they took away is our ability to report.
Later, police raided Eyewitness Video, a cop watch group. Their footage of police arrests at the RNC 4 years ago in New York resulted in hundreds of arrested demonstrators getting off, since the Eyewitness Video footage showed time and again that the police were lying about the circumstances of the arrests.
We heard them basically busting in. Myself and Elizabeth Press and another gentleman in the house had cameras, and we were videotaping and photographing as we heard the police bust through an attic door, yell police, come down the stairs, and enter the living room with a handgun drawn on us.
Come on top of your head, please. On top of your head, please.
Can you notify me about that? That we need anything about it anymore.
Two members of the Pepper Spray Collective, Lambert Rochefort and Joe Lissac, were arrested in St. Paul while covering the protests. They were both held for days, and their cameras were not released until after the story they traveled from Seattle to cover was over. It was a serious blow, which put the lens cap on their reports. Authorities picked up a rock only to drop it on their own feet with the arrest of Democracy Now!'s popular host Amy Goodman and her crew. The police quickly let Amy out of jail as they were inundated with a storm of calls and other pressure demanding her release. Independent filmmaker Flox Rostrum operates Mobile Broadcast News, a school bus that serves as a video production facility, roaming the country to cover underground news. Throughout the RNC, the St. Paul police attempted to break in numerous times without a warrant, forcing the Mobile Broadcast News crew to keep watch 24/7. Domestic preemptive raids and arrests against protest organizers and the press marks an escalation by the authorities. They clearly wanted to cripple the movement and our ability to report on it, and certainly did not want the unblinking eye of the camera trained at them while they did their dirty work. These tactics raise political questions around the constitutional right of freedom of the press and exposes the ugly face of the police state.
right, Butch?
Yeah, I'm all right. They only got one eye. I still got one left.
Good morning, slaves, and welcome to part two of Ground Noise and Static. By now, you probably thought, wait a minute. Where's my eye? Thanks. Okay, so you suckers thought that we were just going to grill the Republicans and let the Democrats off the hook, didn't you? My selecta, rewind shit. Our team of video ninjas went to Denver for the same reasons we covered the protests in St. Police. There is a resistance movement growing throughout the land and all around the world. A movement that is bigger than elections. A movement that broadly unites people across diversity of class, social, political, economic, racial, and gender lines. A movement that in the spirit of the St. Paul principles can live with its many differences, because we are all united against a common enemy. Because we know there is something fundamentally wrong, and even suicidal as a species, with the corporate vision of the future. So the movement went to Denver, just like St. Paul, to proclaim mutiny, to stand and to be counted on the side of the better world that is possible.
When things like this happening, somebody better recreate some struggle. Our immigrant sisters and brothers are being rounded up by the thousands, dragged out like slaves, dragged out of plants and factories, out of their home, thrown in prison. Some of them are dying in prison for lack of medical attention, deported. Some of them are being beaten to death, lynched. Somebody better recreate some struggle. Somebody better recreate some militancy, some unity.
What occupation do we oppose? What war do we oppose? All war? Any war? This war? That war? How about the war that's right here in occupied Denver?
With the DNC coming to town, it's like Santa Claus has dropped off gifts for the Denver Police Department, only these gifts are in the form of new riot shields, new security cameras, and gas canisters to use on protesters.
Have you noticed that with all this talk of stopping terrorists and Bin Laden and all that stuff, and all this militarization and homeland security, that it all comes down to the government's guns pointing at us?
This is what happens in a nuts country, not what happens in America. You can't even walk down the street without them coming out with their war gear on.
You're in charge, and you're instructing these officers to hold me here until you guys cut loose with this gas. Under what freaking authority?
Well, it ain't no doubt that some peeps who were righteously interested in bumping chests with Republicans skipped Denver, really to avoid making the Democrats mad. It is safe to say that those who showed up in Denver, and there were lots of them, were clearly sick of the two-party corporate police state system.
When it came to the Constitution, the Democratic leadership showed us that aiding and abetting illegal spying on us was more important to them than protecting our civil liberties. When it came to war and occupation, the Democratic leadership showed us that financing an illegal and immoral war based on lies was more important to them than the people's desire for peace. And when the people, hurting from the financial mismanagement of this country, called for accountability for the crimes that have been committed against the people here, against the global community, against nature itself, the Democratic leadership took impeachment off the table.
Well, even greater use of clean coal technology.
We need to have clean coal technology.
And that's why we have to invest in clean coal technologies.
The DNC was also being billed as the greenest convention ever by the Dems. and a need to seriously confront green capitalism was seen as a necessary component to the protest.
One of the most prominent things that we see every day is this thing called greenwashing. And it's when corporations will try to say that they're a part of this environmental movement. And so, you know, they're a part of this sustainable paradigm that we all want because we see how unsustainable our current lifestyles are. The problem with that is that these companies aren't part of our sustainable future. And the sooner that we realize that, the sooner that we're going to get rid of them, divest from these companies, let them die, and start building up something that's truly sustainable.
The Clean Coal Lobby was out in force at the DNC, passing out fans and buttons touting the virtues of clean coal without even explaining what it is. Overall, the anti-green capitalism march was a success in causing a spectacle to counteract the damn green image and got into the heads of unsuspecting political tourists. This was a powerful victory as normal folks become disillusioned with the political system and look for real alternatives beyond what is offered by the Democratic leadership. One of the best indicators of how shaky things are for the rich is the role of Iraq vets against the war. Fresh back from the killing fields, these mutineers are driven by their own experiences to confront Democrats and Republicans alike.
I think people need to get out in the streets. I mean, I think it has to be a real movement. GIs have to stop fighting the war. That's how it ends. And they need the support. They need to see people in the streets that are supporting them so that, you know, when they actually resist and when they go AWOL, that the people are there for them.
More and more vets, and now active duty military, are joining IVAW to stand and confront their masters. Ron Kovic, paralyzed Vietnam veteran, whose story is detailed in Oliver Stone's movie Born on the 4th of July, and who in real life rode his wheelchair to disrupt the Republican convention in 1972, never stood so tall as to when he wheeled out of this year's Democratic convention to stand with IVAW as they faced off the cops and their political handlers.
When I have to go inside of a cage to dissent, to question authority, is that the freedom that I sacrificed my body for? We are going to, in the next couple of days, we are going to find that freedom. We are going to allow the American people to know that we are not going to be silenced. That's what being an American is all about. We refuse to be silenced. They will not cage us. We will not go silently into this dark American night.
This was a photo op moment, rank and filed, disciplined, silver bugle and all, standing against the masters of war. Here's how it all went down. Rage Against the Machine rocked out a free concert in front of thousands of fans. Immediately following the show, Rage instructed the crowd to march behind the vets to the Pepsi Center for 5 freaking miles. The plan worked, and about 10,000 amped up peeps walked towards the DNC in an unpermitted march.
We have come here to hold the Democratic Party accountable. We want to talk with Senator Obama. We do not want to hurt you. We don't want you to hurt us.
They stood in mutiny, and the cops, who would immediately attack a similar crowd led by other protest groups, punked out. At one point, the popo started suiting up, preparing for the order to attack. The vets stood unwavering, the crowd on edge. The authorities tried to stall, but the vets determinedly held their ground.
We are!
Awaiting negotiation!
With Senator Obama! The Democratic Party!
Finally, the police blinked, and it felt like a decisive battle had been won.
The veterans liaison is coming out to set up a meeting to talk about when we can read our letter to the delegates.
No doubt the ranks of IVAW will continue to grow with volunteers stepping up to the battle. Their actions reach those unreachable by other means, and by example, they call out on all Americans to exceed the limits, to break ranks, to join the revolution. In conclusion, The Republican conventions of 2008 succeeded in bringing people from all around the country together and cementing strong bonds which will carry on beyond the conventions. See you in the streets.
They tried to use me, but I am not a tool. They tried to lie to me, but I would not be fooled. They tried to bribe me, but I could not be bought. And they tried to stop me, but I would not be stopped. 'Cause we are unbeatable. And we are unstoppable.
What have we done? What have we done? Are we making any changes or just having fun? What have we done? What have we done? Is this more than just music? Is it more than just a club? Are we making any difference? Oh, what have we done? What have we done? What have we done? Well, just take a look around, and I'm sure that you'll agree that we've done a lot of things to improve community, like organizing protests and serving food, not bombs, sending books to all the prisoners that have been locked up for so long. Throwing bricks through all the windows of the evil corporate shops, supporting mom and pop and standing up to the murdering racist cops. Seems like we're always talking about the things we do wrong, but let's not forget to talk about the good things that we've done. Well, no, we've got our faults, and I must say that I agree. But punk rock music saved my life, I can sing it honestly. Sometimes it may seem like we haven't done anything, but I think that we made it a little bit better than it was. That's why I sing, and I'll ask you to sing with me.
Up the punks, up the punks, up the punks. Up the punks, up the punks, up the punks. Up the punks, up the punks, up the punks. Up the punks, up the punks, up the punks.
Thank you. been Glee Glee Productions, specially made for WNRB Central Wisconsin Community Radio. I'm Mike Cannon.